In today's House General Government Committee, appreciate everyone being here. We're just started a little late, I'm sorry. Today I'd like to open a public hearing, possible work session, a public hearing first on HJM 36. Kara, would you like to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Joint Memorial 36 requests the Oregon Congressional Delegation to oppose budget cuts in the federal budget that impact adult vocational and community development funds. The measure further states that the proposed cuts will make it difficult for Oregon workers to obtain and retain gainful employment and will also cause Oregon's workforce to be less competitive. Our federal programs that are central to adult education efforts, including dislocated worker projects, Job Corps, trade adjustment assistance, basic literacy education, and community service block grants, are all subject to be reduced by the next federal budget. Proponents of this measure estimate that Oregon's federal funding may be cut by as much as $170 million should the proposed reductions be approved.
Thank you, Kara. Representative Witt, would you like to speak to this? This is your name first on the...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Brad Witt, a state representative from House District 31, here this morning to describe and support House Joint Memorial 36. As you have just heard from the bill analysis, Oregon is on tap to lose $170 million in workforce and training monies over the next budget cycle. There are some estimates that could actually be as high as $200 million. This is particularly harsh on our state, given the fact that our state in 42 out of the last 4 years, 42 months out of the last 4 years, has either been at or near the top among our 50 states in this country for unemployment. We have a very, very significant need for workforce and economic development programs in this state as a result. These programs have a proven track record in terms of being able to develop job skills of those folks that go through them. We need to make sure that we're able to do everything that we can to make our workforce second to none. Employers repeatedly tell us, I was a former member of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, the education and training programs are among the most critical components of a competitive workforce and a successful business, and workers are abundantly aware of the fact that in order to be able to get a good job in today's economy, one that pays family levels of wages as well as benefits, that high skills and the development and application of those skills are equally important. And I think that you will be hearing here in a moment that our state's workforce professionals are telling us that in a global economy, if our state is to be able to remain competitive, not only with our neighboring states, but the many nations of the world, that we must make every effort to develop the workforce skills of the employees of the state. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for our colleague here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
So I'd like to invite Cam Prost-Browley and Julie Sohanic to come forward and talk further.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cam Preuss-Brawley. I'm the Commissioner for Community Colleges and the Department Director for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And I'm here today to lend my support to the House Joint Memorial Number 36. As Representative Witt has outlined, the proposed federal budget does have what I consider a severe negative impact on Oregon's ability to train and retrain workers in Oregon. Education, skill, and job training do make a difference for Oregon businesses and workers and for our state's economy. The administration's proposed 2006 budget for education and training will dramatically reduce Oregon's ability to train and retrain workers for the jobs of the future. Specifically, Oregon stands to lose, as you have heard, over $170 million. In that proposal is $25 million that would be cut from professional, technical, and adult literacy programs. And this comes at a time when we have recently concluded a study that says that over 500,000 Oregon adults have limited literacy skills. And these are the very foundation skills that everyone needs to participate in the knowledge economy. A cut like this couldn't come at a worse time. The funds provided through these federal programs are heavily matched, in many places more than twice, with local dollars from Oregon's 17 community colleges, our 7 workforce development areas, and community development providers and partners. The reduction or elimination of these federal dollars will further erode accessibility to programs that are vital for Oregon's economic recovery. Oregon's job training programs are currently able to serve less than 5% of the people who are economically eligible for those programs because of the way it's currently funded. And the proposed budget cuts will further restrict our level of service. The governor has written to our congressional delegation urging them to not let these cuts stand. And just as late as yesterday, the House did move to restore some of the vocational education training, but the appropriation action has not been concluded, but there is at least no longer an elimination of the program. There is at least a place to add back vocational dollars, and that's specifically the Carl Perkins vocational education program. So to finish, I just want to say that I do stand with Representative Witt and urge you to pass the joint memorial to ensure that federal dollars that are critical for that are a critical investment in expanding education, workforce, and economic development here in Oregon continue to come our direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Julie, why don't you finish and I'll invite question.
Sure. Good morning, committee. My name is Julie, for the record, my name is Julie Sahanek. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association, which represents Oregon's 17 community colleges and over 330,000 Oregonians. We believe that House Joint Measure 36 sends a very strong message to the Oregon delegation and the U.S. Congress overall that cuts to adult vocational education and community development programs puts at risk the future of Oregon workers. Community colleges are the largest trainer. We train Oregonians for immediate workforce needs. This is a wide variety of training programs from nursing to automotive technology. Over a third of Oregon's community college students are enrolled in professional technical programs, and these programs are very successful. Over 90% of these students participate in professional technical programs, transfer to a post-secondary education, or find employment, depending on their individual educational goals. Over 85% of these students retain their employment or continue to completion through the post-secondary education program. So we know that these programs that are funded at the federal level and matched by the local dollars do have a high success rate and do impact Oregon's economy and workforce structure. What we do know also is that the risk that these federal dollars posed to Oregon is not only the loss of those dollars, but they exacerbate the state problem. Community colleges over the last 2 years have lost $50 million in state funding. This has produced a steady decline in FTE and professional technical programs and adult basic education, and this does put at risk the ability for Oregon to train its own workforce to meet the knowledge-based economy and the skills that are required within that economy. We strongly urge you to support House Joint Memorial 36 and encourage you to send that strong message to our the U.S. Congress that these cuts are not acceptable.
Thank you. Question, how are we doing relatively? What's been the curve on federal funding in these? Has it been dropping? Has it been holding steady? What?
Representative Berger, interestingly enough, particularly federal job training dollars, the worse the economy of a state, actually the better you do in garnering a larger share of the overall federal dollars. Even given that, in the last 4 years, Oregon has lost 6% of its federal workforce dollars.
So the worse we do, the more we get, but we're not holding.
But we're not holding our own because the overall appropriation is also shrinking.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has our delegation weighed in, any members of our delegation weighed in yet on these budget items?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, yes, in the communication that I received yesterday, both Representative Wu and Walden, and as far as I can tell, all of our delegation, House members, voted for the restitution of, they aren't calling it Carl Perkins, they have a different name for it, but for vocational education yesterday, to at least bring the program back.
Very good.
So, yes, I think they are hearing us.
Okay.
Representative Kim.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Kim, can you give us a real-life of example of one of the programs that's impacted by the $770 million that's going on in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Cameron, yes, as Ms. Sulhanik said, nursing programs, many of our vocational education programs are the professional development and keeping the curriculum current with the needs of the industry standards is what the Carl D. Perkins funds support at the both the community college and the high school level. And so if we were not to receive these funds, they are extremely expensive programs. Most professional technical programs require expensive equipment and need to be, you know, routinely updated so that they are meeting the needs of the industry. Nursing is probably not the best example, but there are critical shortage areas in nursing, automotive technology programs of that description. I do want to say that they have also, the Bush administration has also proposed to reduce by almost 75% adult literacy funding. And all of the Carl D. Perkins advocates have come and have helped restore that piece of funding, or at least that program. We will await the funding. The Adult Basic Skill and English as a Second Language advocacy group is not does not quite have the same voice in Congress. Those funds are still at risk, and as I said, we have months and months and months of waiting lists at Oregon's community colleges to serve people who lack literacy skills in order to get into collegiate programs in order to get the skills that they need to enter the workforce. So we're most concerned about that.
Further.
Oh, thank you. The nursing is an interest as sitting on Health and Human Services and knowing the shortages that we have in the medical. What would this do? I mean, do you have any idea how many nurses we train in the state today and what this would, if we didn't get this type of funding from the federal government, what it would do to the number of nurses we're training today, and we know we need more? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Madam Chair, Representative Cameron, I'm going to be very frank. I don't know how many we train. I'd like to bring that information back and specifically let you know what the impact on nursing training would be without this resource.
Thank you. Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Lee?
So, you know, these memorials are obviously non-binding, but am I accurate in that this legislature could, I don't know if mitigates the proper term, but we do have direct power in terms of the community college budget, and would that Is that an accurate statement? And could you talk a little bit about that and how that might impact what we're trying to do here?
Chair Berger, Representative Glizzo, you are correct. While I think we cannot turn a blind eye to the impact that $170 million in federal funding would do, I think it is important that Oregon does have a responsibility for providing the state share. As I mentioned before, we have been cut over $50 million in just the last 2 years, but if you look over our trending line, we have never really been fully funded at the need that we need. Just to put it on to the record, the need that we would need to be funded at with the current population and the demand we have in the state of Oregon is $650 million. The budget negotiations right now are somewhere between 428 and 433. While that is still below what we would need, which is 440, to maintain tuition and services as is, there is more that we can do. We do recognize the tight fiscal climate that we are in and that we are one of many public services, but I can assure you that you get a bang for your buck when you fund the community colleges.
Further questions? Appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
No one else?
No.
Okay. We have no one else signed up, and I am going to close the public hearing and open a work session. Close the public hearing on HJM 36 and open a work session on HJM 36. Further comments from the panel?
I was just surprised that Representative Galicia didn't argue back on the need for funding for community colleges.
I don't know why you would be. Representative Witt, this is...
Madam Chair, I move House Joint Memorial 36 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation.
Representative Witt moves House Joint Memorial 36 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation. Is there any further comment on this? Any... discussion? So ordered. And thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you, Representative Witt, for it is non-binding, but we need to make a clear statement. These are critical needs right now in Oregon. So thank you for bringing this forward. And I will assign Representative Witt to carry this.
Thanks.
Surprise. And close the public hearing. And close the work session on House Joint Memorial 36. Kara, thank you for keeping me here. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2157. As most of the folks in this room know, this has been a major effort. Representative Galizio, Representative Cameron have been particularly, and the work group have worked very, very hard to get this omnibus fingerprinting bill to us. Unfortunately, these major amendments did not come in until quite late, so it is not my intention to actually move this bill today. Just because you folks have not had enough of a chance to read through them. If we're going to do it, let's take a little more time and do it right. So in the meantime, Representative Galizio and Representative Cameron, I'll ask you first to talk a little bit about what you've done and where we are, and I think we'll start there.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And obviously, it's a huge challenge, and this is going to be an ongoing discussion and debate beyond this legislature, and I hope that we're going to have an interim committee and talk about it. I mean, obviously, it's very try to balance security and public safety with right to privacy is not something easily done, and we can especially see at the federal level what a challenge that is. So obviously here, and you know, that is the attempt, and to codify that into statute is a challenge. But having said that, this has been the process, at least I think, has been eye-opening and interesting, and the attempt has been to involve a lot of groups. I think some 40 different agencies and groups have been involved. We did have four different forums and discussions where groups could come and offer their assessment and ideas and input and feedback, and that was really helpful. And I before I go on, I just really want to thank Representative Cameron and Carolyn Fisher and Tricia Whitfield from the State Police, and most important, from my perspective, Virginia Vanderbilt of Legislative Council.
Thank you, Virginia.
If you're watching, thank you very much. Very, very helpful and instructive. So anyway, so we had forums, four of those, and we sought to achieve some type of consensus to, you know, bringing up the issues and trying to see where we can come to consensus. And there was, like I said, there was active participation. I mean, there's a long list of groups from the Board of Nursing to the ACLU, TriMet, DHS, and the list goes on. So I really wanted to thank, I know by singling out some individuals, I'm leaving out a panoply of people. I just thank you very much. So some of the major changes that are included in 2157, you know, we had three agencies come forward immediately, you know, the chiropractic, Board of Chiropractics, the medical examiners, and the nursing board. And then, of course, this started to grow. So we included additional state agencies. And one of the keys was to try to figure out some kind of a criteria or adopt some strict administrative rules that address the circumstances where fingerprinting and therefore nationwide background checks could be implemented. In other words, if you are going to require something such as fingerprinting and looking at national database, there needs to be strict administrative rules in terms of you know, how that's going to be, you know, why it's required and how it's going to be implemented, and why those checks are necessary for public safety. Because obviously the concern is we shouldn't be fingerprinting people without justification. You know, why are we doing this? The 2157 eliminated references to local government. I think that's going to be something that's going to have to be discussed in the future, but currently that we did that. The goal was to provide some consistent language so agencies with similar concerns are treated in an equal manner. And one of the, I think, probably more contentious issues is in terms of fingerprinting. You know, what happens to those fingerprints? The 2157 instructs, and I hesitate to use the word requires, because we really do not have jurisdiction over the FBI, as far as I know. But
we're working on it.
But as Tricia Whitfield of State Police said, you know, there's a clear instruction that the fingerprints and the facsimiles thereof need to be destroyed. So Representative Buckley will be following up on that in Washington, D.C. No, so that is what's instructed, and we hope the FBI does indeed follow that. Also, providing another element of this was to provide agencies with a means to collect fees necessary to cover the expenses of the national background check. And, you know, obviously, in a time of shortfalls in budgets, didn't want to make this a new revenue stream. So, I mean, all the agencies were very clear that this is not a moneymaker. It's to cover the expenses, and that's all you can do. Also, in terms of contested cases, and Department of Health Human Services was very instructive here, informing us that some, I think it was almost 50% of cases whereby an applicant, for example, some kind of a red flag came up, there is in their administrative rule clear parameters in terms of what people can do when there's a contested case. In other words, if you perceive that your application there's a false positive, in other words, something was flagged, there's a clear contested case provision. I mean, I think that's really critical. And in DHS's example, I think we heard of that quite often something arises, but then through the contested case process, that's taken care of. So that's a really critical, and I hope we got that as well. Also, TriMet informed us of Homeland Security edicts that needed to be part of 2157. So that was fascinating. So that was included as well. And also, we instructed the Board of Nursing and DHS to share the results of the checks when both of those agencies require fingerprints of the same individual, right? Because sometimes you have Board of Nursing and DHS having the same individual. So a sharing of a process whereby they can share that information. So those are some of the major factors, and I think Representative Cameron was...
And I would like to invite Representative Cameron to continue.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Galizio, for the update. I also want to say thanks to many of you that are out there and that were a real important part of this, and Andrea, for your... just help and support and getting to where we could have some agreement to move this thing forward. Really want to recognize you for that, and thank you and Tricia for all the time, and also for Georgina, who had a great model that we could take some things from, and appreciate that. Confident that these amendments that we'll look at today, we're not going to pass this bill, but that we've made some move forward. But there's many issues that are going to demand further study and further attention. And so we don't have time this session to deal with all those issues. And I'd just like to highlight some of those issues for the record that we need to follow up on probably in off session. One is how do we include local governments in the process? And there are some models out there that we'd like to look at and explore further because they need to be able to do this. Personally, before I get into some more of these, personally, when I sat in Health and Human Services and heard the first hearing of a bill that's going to be on the House floor today, actually, on the medical examiners, I kind of looked and said, you mean we have doctors setting up shop in the state of Oregon and we're not doing background checks on them? So there is a huge public safety issue here and concern that we need to explore. And I think the general public thinks those things are going on, and we need to make sure as a body that we continue this process to protect them as well as protect the rights of individuals. How do we make the process more user-friendly for those who submit fingerprints? There were some issues in that came out that we need to really take a look at that. Where are they going to be taken, and how is it user-friendly? Representative Galizio and I are going to start a business. It's called Cameron and Galizio Associates. The role of independent fingerprinters in the state of Oregon, and how are fingerprints being taken, and where are they being taken, and what's been done with them, and the oversight process of that. We need to set forth meeting the needs of our other state agencies and licensing boards as they come forward for the future, and making the process easy for them to follow and develop a standard of rules and guidelines to get in the ability to do that. Basically, a clearinghouse, maybe exploring a clearinghouse right now. I mean, DHS's name came up in the work group as they're doing a lot of the work for our state, but is there going to be a way that we can have a clearinghouse model that is able to do this, and as well as save money and efficiency, so we're not having, you know, somebody's going from one job to the next and being fingerprinted three times over a period of a year. So we've really got to explore that option. And should there be a way to transfer some of the data? And I think in the amendments on 2157, there is a little bit of a model there where Department of Nursing and DHS are going to be able to share some information back and forth within a specific period of time. But that interagency and use would be important to do. So I'd like to go on record today that these issues need to be addressed and should be addressed, and suggest that the committee formally request that Speaker Minnis to consider appointing an interim committee to fully examine this complex role. And I'd like to also give Tricia Whitfield a chance to come up and maybe walk through. Do we want to go through the amendments?
Yes, it was my intention to ask.
Yeah. So request the interim committee as well as Tricia. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Tricia, please come forward. Invited testimony. And Tricia is the only invited testimony today. As I think I've indicated, we will not be voting this. And we will probably have a little more invited testimony the next time we meet. But it is my intention to move this bill at our next session, which is Tuesday. But I did want a lot of people worked very hard on this bill. These amendments need another read. So Tricia, welcome, and if you wouldn't mind going through the amendments a little bit with us,
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Should we ask questions as we go through, or should we?
I think as we go through would be the best way to do it. Let's get them.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police Identification Services Section. And
your voice is very low. Could you put that a little closer? Thank you.
Is that better?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. That's better.
Okay. Do I need to repeat myself?
No, we know who you are.
Okay. as you know, as you've mentioned, that the Dash 2 amendments did come out rather late, so a lot of folks haven't seen them. I did take a few minutes to go through, actually I guess a couple of hours, to go through them and highlight some areas. Primarily I was focusing on the Dash 2s because I think Virginia Vanderbilt did do us a favor by sort of replacing large areas, so you don't have to go a lot of back and forth. And I will do that at your request. And we'll be happy to answer any questions that I can throughout, although there are some areas that I'm not necessarily familiar with because I wasn't as involved with the input because it went straight through to the committee. So on those areas, I'll be sure and let you know that I don't know.
We'll tally up the unanswered and get them on Tuesday.
And much of it was covered by Representatives Galizio and Cameron. So I will start, again, going off of the Dash 2s on page 1. As noted, Section 1, which had to do with local government, was deleted. And happy to hear that there will be continued work on that because I know that's an important need as well. Section 2, which is the main area that Oregon State Police was concerned about as well as to support local government need, that has changed quite a bit. It's grown in its size, and I think that's clearly the result of the work group. And it was a very collaborative effort and interesting. It has changed the scope of it in a way that there are a lot more bits and pieces to it. The definition of authorized agency on lines 14 and 15 and 16 now reads, does not include Oregon State Lottery Commission and Oregon State Lottery. Moving on to page 2. Lines 16 through 21 are instructing the state police to destroy the fingerprint cards when only a state check is done. An agency may do a state check and a nationwide check if they choose to stop at the statewide and there are fingerprints submitted. This was just a clarification that we will, in fact, destroy the fingerprint cards. And the state police is prepared to do the destruction of all those cards that are mentioned to be destroyed when they're submitted to us. Subsection 7, lines 22 through 26, is further clarifying that an authorized agency may conduct their own name-based check through law enforcement data system, and that's sort of a pre-screening if they want to do that check as opposed to going through to the fingerprint check. Once they determine that they do need to do a fingerprint check, then they'd go beyond that. That was just to clarify that they may do that. Lines 29 and 30, and then moving on to page 3, lines 1 and 2. Some clarification that information I had received that the FBI will allow for. We knew that they would allow the subject individual to inspect their criminal history. They also will allow that a copy be provided for the subject individual at their request. That is only after the fingerprints have been positively identified. We know that that is that person's record. So that's a benefit to the agencies in their process. Also on page 3, clarification on lines 5 and 6 having to do with adopting the rules. Those rules are pertaining to when the information is obtained, the criminal history record information is obtained based on fingerprint check. On line 14 of page 3, the change there is specifying the types of crimes rather than the actual crimes, so it's a little broader statement. These rules must be adopted, and they're not necessarily limited to these items, but that actually does broaden and hopefully will make things easier for the decision making. Lines 20 and 21, if the authorized agency uses criminal records checks for agency employment, there's new provisions there. Line 22 adds under what conditions that a subject individual may be hired on a preliminary basis. That used to be probationary, so there's some cleanup there on the language. Line 30 of page 3, the Department of State Police shall verify that an authorized agency has adopted the rules required by subsection 9 of the section. And the discussion there was that the state police will, in our process of signing an agreement with each of these agencies to gain access to the criminal history files, we will make sure that they do have their rules adopted. We will make note of that. However, we won't necessarily review those rules and make sure that they are adequate. We will make sure that they do have them in place according to this statute. And the remainder of page 4 and 5, I believe, and excuse me for not having made good enough notes here. That is some additional clarification for adopting the rules there. This is the part that I mentioned that I can't speak to because I'm not positive. I don't recall where these topics came from. I do recall discussions on them, but they're getting more intricate into the actual decision-making and the rules that will apply to those decisions based on criminal histories.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is a section where I do have some questions on concerning this decision that's made over a potential employee's fitness or unfitness for the position. With the language, I guess I would need to know who we can ask these questions of. On page 5, section 13, lines 10 and 11 talk about a decision that's made in good faith. And if that is a legal definition, I'd like to know that. The section 13 holds the agency or an employee of the agency immune from civil liability. And it's just an area I would like to have clarified. Is there any scenario, for instance, where a decision made by the agency, jumping back again onto page 4, line 28, the likelihood of a repetition of offenses, someone is making a judgment call there and then that judgment call is being held immune from civil liability. I would just like some clarification on how that process works, whether that is a common practice for agencies or a common part of the agency's rules.
Okay, these are fair questions.
Not being an attorney, I mean, whenever we hire anybody, we make judgment calls, and this is another one of those situations where the rules would set out that for a particular job, let's say if somebody had been convicted of embezzlement, and now they're applying for a job in Department of Revenue, is that going to match up? And so that each agency has to look at what are those offenses that would probably raise a flag and potentially preclude somebody from employment in that particular job. If they were applying for some other job in the Department of Revenue, I'm just throwing that out as an example, and, you know, as a secretary, they had no access to, an assistant that had no access to information or files or whatever, maybe that person would be hired based on that. So I think the you've got to come up with some decision-making process, and I think what we heard from DHS was really a great thing, and Representative Galizio and maybe DHS or somebody could, it was like 50% of those challenged, or maybe it was higher than that, 50% of the, in other words, if I was denied employment because of these this situation, and I come back and challenge it, 50% of the people were overturned, or were got through the process for the second time. So I think that was a critical element, that there is a process that people have the right to appeal if they were denied. Because there is, you are sitting in a seat making a judgment, but we also need to have the ability to listen to extenuating circumstances within that. And that's where the appeals process is really important in there. I don't know about the civil liability and limiting that, because I'm not an attorney, but I do think we heard from counsel that there's some language we'll put in there, but she even said, well, what's that mean?
Right, you know, that's my question.
Right. And I don't remember if that was referenced to this or not.
We will ask for further clarification of this.
I am reassured, just a quick comment back, I am reassured that there is a, given that there is a nexus between the probably past record of someone and the job they're being considered would hopefully take that potential liability out of the situation. In your instance, the secretary would not have access to a checkbook. So, hopefully.
Yeah.
Further questions? Good. Please proceed.
Okay. The next changes that I had highlighted are skip way through the document. To actually section 3, which pertains to Department of Human Services and Employment Department, is much the same as it had been. I think that
what page you on?
I'm sorry, I hadn't really landed on a page. I'm sorry. Section 3 starts on page 6, and I believe that it goes clear to, well, my next landing point would be page 14. Sorry. Okay. But just to highlight that in bringing Department of Human Services and Employment Department back into that section 2, that main part, some of the duplicated language was cleaned up in this particular dash 2, but there wasn't anything substantial to discuss. So on page 14, line 14 talks about page 12 of the original bill. And I, this part I think I'd like to summarize because it does get you going back and forth between the different documents. Specifically, page 12 of the written bill, line 4, has to do with Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And it was a matter of wordsmithing to include licensing and reissuance of licenses. They are tasked with issuing licenses to retired police officers, and this helps them to obtain doing those types of checks. There is also a lot of language throughout that adds employees instead of just an applicant, but actual current employees. That was in, and then it was out, now it's back in. On page 14, line 9, some more cleanup, but lines 17 through 22 are having to do with the Department of Energy and the Department of Administrative Services. They do not issue licenses, certificates, or registrations, so the changes there reflect that. On line 23 of page 14 is also referring to Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. It's just adding them to the section 2. Cleanup on line 27, state lands. Many of the agencies, again, within the work group, discussed the types of subject individuals they wanted to check, and that language is to clean up the types of applicants they would be checking, and that happens throughout. Moving on to page 15. Lines 11 through 15 have to do with requiring the state police retain the fingerprint cards on file for background checks performed for state fire marshal's explosives permit. I missed that in the beginning. State fire marshal has, we've retained those types of fingerprint cards for many, many years, so this was bringing them back to the current process as we had done with others.
This has always been the case that those explosive permits have been kept on file?
Madam Chair, yes, it's correct.
And they are kept by the state police?
Correct.
And it is only specific to this fire marshal function of explosive permit?
Correct. On page 15, lines 26 through 28 are more cleanup. I think wordsmithing that council did, changing statewide to just state regarding the fingerprint checks. And I'm now going to skip several pages, moving to page 19 of the dash 2s. Lines 15 through 21 have to do with the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. And I believe that this is just a language that they have added. I won't speak to it because I don't want to give you wrong information. I think it is in line with their individual bill that's also going through the legislature to do the same. And moving on to page 24, similar bill that you heard about, there were those three agencies. This has to do with the Board of Medical Examiners. It's just highlighting the types of individuals they will be checking. And I believe that legislative council in all of these boards tried to put in language that was going to be consistent. That was one of the goals. And the language here, applying for a license that's issued by the board, applying for renewal of a license, and for parties that are under investigation by the board, I think you find that that's been standardized in these dash twos throughout. The next change, as I've noted, on page 27, same type of thing, same agency, Board of Medical Examiners. Line 22 and 23 is deleting 49, which had to do with the State Lottery Commission, and that the changes were not renumbered. Next change is on line 24, adding section 50, having to do with the Department of Revenue. Same standard type language. These subsequent sections are each individually referring to agencies that either have current statutory authority to do background checks and maybe are seeking to do a nationwide check, or maybe they don't have access currently and are being added to the process through these sections. On page 28, mentions the section 53 is the Board of Accountancy. One change that I learned, see on lines 20 and 21, that this agency deals with accountants that are licensed in another state, but they apply for the authority to practice in the state of Oregon, and this will allow them to do a background check on them, even though they're licensed in another state. Section 54 is having to do with the Board of Dentistry. Again, the standard language being added for current employees or someone that is applying for renewal of a license or it's under investigation by the board. Page 29, Parks and Rec, it is also adding current employees. Section 56 is for the state bar, is adding renewal of license. There was a point that was made that agencies wanted not only the licensing but the renewal as well, just for clarification. And more of the same for other agencies listed there. Moving on to page 30. On page 30, section 61 is adding Oregon Youth Authority. Oregon Youth Authority has had the authority to do fingerprint checks and have been both state and nationwide for some time, but for whatever reason, they were not included. They didn't show up on the word find or whatever it was that Virginia used, and so it was just a point of bringing them into the picture like the other agencies that have been doing background checks. On page 31, section 62, I believe, is a new agency to this bill, the Board of Psychologist Examiners. And their statutory language is being amended to add them to the process in section 2, which on page 32 is standard language, lines 15 through 18, to tie it to that common practice. Moving on to page 34, section 64 is another agency that's new to the process, Department of Environmental Quality, and they have expressed their need to do background checks and specified who it is that they're checking on, employed or applying for employment in the department's laboratory, contractors that are working in the laboratory, positions that are working in treatment, disposal, or storage of chemical warfare agents.
Hmm. I was going to ask, you know. Okay, I get it. Thank you. I was visualizing sewage treatment workers, not your usual.
On page 35, it was mentioned previously that TriMet was including an amendment. The transportation districts throughout the state do have current authority, as does TriMet, and we understand that they do have new requirements from the federal government to do Homeland Security type of checks. And on page 36 specifically, lines 4 through 12 indicate that those types of checks that they are doing, as well as the current checks that are for the safety of vulnerable populations that are riding on the transit districts, this is limited to areas where there's a population of 500,000 or more. And as far as I know, TriMet is the only transit district in the state of Oregon that meets that requirement. Page 37 is still the transit district, and while it's not, they are not a state agency, they're staying in their own statute, but there were some changes made to bring them closer into the process, and one of them being subsection 7 at the top of page 37 is ordering that we destroy the fingerprint cards at state police, where the current practice is we return them back to the submitting agency. More of that goes on for the next several pages. Nothing highly significant. I'm now on page 41. We're on the home stretch here. Section 66 is also addressing a new agency to the process, the Health Licensing Office. And we need to go all the way to page 43 to find out who it is that they're checking on, and it is much the same as the others. Any kind of a licensing agent would be for certificates, licenses, registrations, and anyone that's under investigation by the agency. Section 67 at the bottom of page 43, you already heard about. Department of Human Services and the Board of Nursing will enter into an interagency agreement to share information obtained from the FBI. That's something that we checked on and it is encouraged. That's a cost saver, and it seems so obvious that they're doing checks on the same types of people for the same reasons at the same time that they might be able to eliminate duplication, and that is approved by FBI as long as there is an interagency agreement. They do not require it to be in statute, however. And on page 44, section 68 is another new agency, Board of Pharmacy. Same standard language, and that is it for the changes that I noted in very brief summary.
Easy, huh?
See how sexy this work is?
Yeah.
It's really a lot of fun.
I looked up and everyone's pouring through page by page. It's nice to see everyone working so hard today. Your statement is just like... further questions, comments from the panel? I have one concerning the exclusion of the lottery, and I understand there's somebody here from the lottery who could explain. Would you mind coming forward and explain the lottery exclusion? And stay here, Tricia. There's two microphones. There may be more. I don't want to.
I don't know that person.
And if you could identify yourself and explain why the lottery exclusion.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Warren. I'm the Human Resources Manager at the Oregon Lottery. The lottery asked to be excluded from this bill because there is already quite a bit of statutory language that covers the lottery's authorization and need to conduct fingerprint checks and extensive background checks, not only on applicants for employment, but also for any businesses that we purchase products from, and also the retailers that carry lottery products, the retailers, their employees, and in fact, the vendors that we do business with, even investors. The purpose, I'm sure you can imagine, is to ensure the integrity of the lottery products, and as the state continues to rely on the revenue from the lottery, we think it is in the best interest to continue the current administration of this process.
Would you characterize the lottery's process as being quite a bit more rigorous than what is described here? In
to
terms
some
of the number of people and the frequency and the...
To some extent, I would say that it is. We do the fingerprint. There is, as you all probably know, a Oregon State Police section that actually sits in the lottery and runs the security of the lottery. And they do the fingerprint work. There are trained officers that do the fingerprinting, do the FBI checks. But we do it at least annually on every employee and on every person that we do business with to ensure that there are no violations that come up in the interval.
Chairman?
Okay. Yes.
Question. Thank you. I'm curious, under Section 2 of this, there's some criteria for setting up procedures. Can you maybe describe for the
committee your procedures, what's happening to the fingerprints, and you know, who takes them, where they're taken, and being fingerprinted about 15 years ago by the Oregon State Lottery, and now having burnt my fingers, would I have to be there? So could you describe for us that process and the security that's going on? I'm curious.
Madam Chair and Representative Cameron, the fingerprints are almost always taken at the lottery by in the security section. And so that they're not distributed anywhere else. They're highly safeguarded not only is the lottery almost a complete lockdown area in the first place, but the security section is even more so. There are occasions when fingerprints are taken in other portions of the state. I am actually not certain where they're done, but I will find out where they are done and get back to you with that.
What happens to the fingerprints at the lottery?
We keep the cards in the security section on file.
And what's the purpose for keeping them on file?
Because we reprocess them each year.
Okay.
Further questions?
I do have one.
Yes.
Please. Page 37, line 2 through 6, appears to be an exact reiteration of page 2, line 16 through 21. It's the language of destroying the fingerprint cards. Is there a purpose, reason?
Representative Sumner, I believe that you said page 37. That is having to do with the transit districts and mass transit, and they have their own individual statute that previously did not have the destruction of the fingerprint cards in it, and because they're not a state agency, they're not being included in the omnibus bill to tie them to the Section 2, where the standard process now would be to have state police destroy the fingerprint cards. And Legislative Council added those few pieces to bring them closer to the process, even though they are not a state agency and separate from the authorized agency definition.
Thank you.
Yes.
Also, there's frequent references to the to fingerprinting volunteers. Are we going to be able to successfully enact that? If they're not agency employees, and I do understand the reason for doing it, and I agree with the reason, but are we going to legally be able to include volunteers in the same class as state employees?
Representative Sumner, there are currently volunteers that are being fingerprinted for specific positions.
And I agree with it.
I am assuming, I know we are doing that, and I believe that it is lawful. It depends on the position, of course. And each agency has added their own needs in their own section, whether they have that need or not. I couldn't speak to, but if they do have volunteers that they feel the need to check because they're in a specific position or working in a certain area, then they are included in this.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question in the lottery. When you said we keep the fingerprints for reprocessing, what does that mean?
Madam Chair, Representative Lucio, we do recheck on at least an annual basis those who are qualified to work at the lottery or, you know, are our current employees or people that we do business with, either our retailers or our vendors, to ensure that there have been no violations that would exclude them from doing business with the lottery.
Okay.
That makes sense.
It actually is more user-friendly for the people who are subject to this background check because they don't have to come back in and get fingerprinted.
In other words, you just rerun the same fingerprint.
Exactly.
In case they might have committed a crime over the...
Any further questions of this panel? Any further? Well, then I will send everyone off to diligently read this. some issues have been brought forward in a letter to me from the
Teacher Standards and Practices Commission regarding the Dash 2s. I don't believe they will hold this up. We will deal with them probably as this legislation moves forward, but I will distribute to the committee a letter from Vicki Chamberlain and explaining some things, but we're not going to go back and redo this, and we appreciate that. We will deal with these specific issues as it moves through the process to get some other changes. Barring that, please go home, do your homework, and we will revisit this on Tuesday. And thank you all. Thank Virginia, if you're listening. We love you. And
Virginia.
And all of you who work so diligently on this, who are about to leave. Thank you all. This is a big deal. It is hard work. And I just can't tell you how much we appreciate all the efforts of all the folks who have been at the table trying to make a workable program for the state. And guess what? We get to do it all again in the interim, but it's worth doing. Thank you.
And Kara, too.
And Kara, too. And Kara, too. It is my intent to consider House Bill 2157 at our next meeting. And I will close this work session on House Bill 2157. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2917. Kara, remind us of this. We have some more amendments to go through.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You remember that House Bill 2917 was actually introduced by the committee at the request of State Lands and the State Treasurer. It's the piece that transfers the authority to manage unclaimed property from the Department of State Lands to the State Treasurer. At the time that you received the initial testimony on this bill, we were told that amendments were coming. You have those amendments in front of you today. And, Madam Chair, I would respectfully request that you ask representatives from the Treasurer's office to walk us through their amendments.
Probably a good idea. Inga Deckard is here and has offered to come forward and talk about the amendments. And so, Inga, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Inga Deckard with the Oregon State Treasury. The Dash 1 amendments were put forward to make technical corrections to the bill. As you can imagine, moving a program from one state agency to another is complicated from a technical standpoint, and the Dash 1 amendments are just generally technical amendments that are necessary to properly effectuate the transfer of the program from the Department of State Lands to Treasury. So rather than walk through the amendments section by section, I thought I would just summarize them and then be happy to answer any questions you have about specific sections or specific language in the amendments. So the amendments do just a handful of things. They specify that the bill will become operative on July 1st of 2006, but that the Treasurer can take any actions necessary in preparation to make that transfer and can be reimbursed for its expenses in doing so. The amendments also authorize Treasury to pay claims to rightful owners and pay expenses of operating the program as opposed to DSL. And as you'll remember from the Treasurer's testimony on the last hearing that we had on this bill, we're not making any changes with respect to where the unclaimed property or the earnings go. All of that still goes into the Common School Fund. The amendments also provide the Treasurer access to administrative law judges from the administrative hearings office so that a person who believes that he or she has a claim for property and feels that they were aggrieved by the decision from the Treasurer's office on that claim, that person then may request a contested case hearing by an administrative judge. And this is necessary because Treasury is exempt from the statutes dealing with contested cases heard by administrative law judges. So we just needed to make sure that that was covered. And the only change in the bill that is beyond merely a technical amendment is the statute that requires certain agencies to assist in to assist either, well, right now it's Department of State Lands, it would be the treasurer, in determining who is required to file a report under the statute and also include information about the program in their regular mailings. We made changes to this portion of the statute to also require assistance in helping us find people who may have a claim for property that we are holding, and we also added the Employment Department and DCBS to the list of assisting agencies. We allow these agencies also to provide us with assistance by including information about the Unclaimed Property Program on their website. We've worked with the agencies on these changes. However, the changes related to the Employment Department, the language that we got back from Legislative Council, and some of the terminology that they used might not quite be exactly what we need, so we may need to go in and just tweak that provision. But that's all I had for prepared testimony today. I'd just be happy to answer any questions that you might have about any of the questions. Language in the Dash 1 amendments.
Questions from this panel? I see that State Lands is here. If there's they have not signed up, and that's fine, but they are here if there are questions. I think these are pretty technical amendments. I appreciate you coming in. And again, it is my intent to consider House Bill 2157 at our next meeting, and not today. We've also, I see, lost two of our panel members. So thank you, and members of the committee or any of the rest of you, if there's something else that comes up on this, we've got till Tuesday. So thank you very much for your patience. Did you have a question?
You said 21.
Whoops. What I mean to say. 2917. Thank you. Got the wrong thing. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So I'm going to close this work session on House Bill 2917. And open, where are two members? A public hearing and on... Okay, then I'm going to open a work session on House Bills 3301A engrossed. Remind us, please, Kara, about this. We heard testimony. It was very brief.
Madam Chair, you heard earlier from Lane County for their request for 3301. It authorizes the formation of county service districts with overlapping jurisdictions if districts are authorized to provide different services. You have before you today a new piece for the record, a letter from Anna Morrison, the chair of the Lane County Board of Commissioners, requesting your support of the legislation. And Tony Bina, their legislative liaison, is in the room. Should you have additional questions?
No questions. We are in work session.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendments to the 3301A.
Representative Buckley moves the Dash 2 amendments, A2 to 3301. Any objections? So ordered. Please note that Representative Esquivel, Representative Cameron are excused this time.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves House Bill 3303A2 engrossed. 3301 to the board with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? So ordered. Please note Representative Esquivel, Representative Cameron are excused at this time. I think, committee members, this is Representative Farr's bill, and I will request that she carry this for us since this came from her and is an important bill to her. So with your permission, I will ask that. Thank you for your work, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3301 and close this meeting of the General Government Committee.
I hope that's